This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut took his life with an overdose of prescription muscle relaxers, those of us who work on Fresh Air were upset and shocked. He died on Christmas Day at the age of 45. At the beginning of December, Chestnut was a guest on our show, and we were all very moved by his story and his music. One of the things he talked about in our interview was his song Flirted With You All My Life. It's a song about suicide, and Chestnut talked about how he had attempted suicide at various times in his life. But his song was a breakup song with death and had the refrain, "Oh, death, I'm not ready." Vic Chestnut had been what's called an incomplete quadriplegic since a 1983 car accident when he was 18. He was in a wheelchair but had limited movement in his arms and legs and would record and tour frequently. Today we remember Chestnut by listening back to excerpts of his interview and by talking to three of his close friends, Michael Stipe of R.E.M., Guy Picciotto of Fugazi, who played on a couple of Chestnut's albums, and Jem Cohen, who worked with Chestnut on many film and music projects. We'll begin with my interview with Vic Chestnut and with that song that I just mentioned, Flirted With You All My Life.
I am a man. I am self-aware, and everywhere I go, you're always right there with me. I've flirted with you all my life, and even kissed you once or twice, and to this day I swear it was nice, but clearly I was not ready. When you touched a friend of mine, I thought I would lose my mind, but I found out with time that really I was not ready. No, no. Oh, death. Oh, death.
Last month, I asked Vic Chestnut about that song. Vic, let's talk about the lyric. The song is about flirting with suicide, but from what I've read, you've done more than flirt with it. It's something you've tried.
Right. Well, this song is a love song. It's a suicide's breakup song with death. You know, I've attempted suicide 3 or 4 times. It didn't take. And this is really a breakup song with death. You know, it's talking about flirting. I'd flirted with death my whole life. Even as a young kid, I was sick and almost died a few times. And then suicide attempts. It's a kind of, you know, it's a breakup song.
Did you try to kill yourself even before the accident?
I did, yeah.
And after the accident?
I did, yeah.
And each time when you came through, when, as you put it, death didn't take, were you relieved or sorry?
Well, it's more complex. I couldn't say either, you know. I mean, you know, sometimes I'd be angry. Angry that they revived me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd be like, how dare you, you know. How dare you people interfere in my, what is, you know, obviously my life, my wish. But, you know, of course, as, you know, the hours and days wear on, you know, you realize, well, there is joy to be had. I mean, this is how I'm sure everybody's different, you know, just how it struck me, you know, when the days would wear on, you know, I would start to, you know, see some joy again in the world and be like, whew, I squeaked that one out.
This is such an emotionally heavy album. is it hard to write a song like this about flirting with suicide? Or is it therapeutic to write it, or, you know?
Well, it occurred to me that I would like to sing this song where at the first half of it, you think I'm singing about a lover. And then it becomes obvious that I'm singing about death. Death is my lover. And it took a bit of time to get it to fit just right and to work. And when we were actually cutting the track, it was hard to make it through without kind of breaking down emotionally and just crying. You know, it's a heavy song, no doubt about it.
Now, one of the heavy lines in it is about your mother. You're right, when my mom was cancer sick, she fought but then succumbed to it. But you made her beg for it. Lord Jesus, please, I'm ready. How old were you when she died?
I was in my mid-20s. And that's the thing about a suicidal person, I think, is that, you know, what I mean, right after my mom died was like one of my last suicide attempts. It really destroyed me. My dad had died a year before, and that was the end of my whole close family, who had all died off within 2 or 3 years of each other. My grandpa, my grandma, my other grandma, my mom, and my dad, they all died off in a couple of years. And so I felt lost, and I was depressed. But also, you see a suicidal person, when you see somebody else die of natural causes or whatever, for me, it's also a kind of wake-up call.
Tell me more about what the effect that had.
Well, like when my friends have died or something like that, it made me feel silly. My sorrow seems silly, and that I'm not ready to go. As I said in the song, the sweet relief, I don't deserve the sweet relief of death yet, because I haven't accomplished my tasks yet.
I want to say one thing about
this song. This song is a joyous song, though. I mean, it's a heavy song, but it is a joyous song. This is a breakup song with death, you know what I mean?
Right, because you're saying clearly I wasn't ready. So
I'm not ready to kill myself, you know? Yeah. It's a joyous song, so, and it has these very heavy aspects, you know, but it's a joyous song.
We're listening back to an interview I recorded a few weeks ago with songwriter and singer Vic Chesnut, who took his life and died on Christmas Day. Here's another dramatic song from his last album. It's called Coward.
Courage of the coward is greater than all others. A scaredy cat'll scratch you if you back 'em in a corner. But I'm
Vic Chestnut, that is one really powerful song. Let's start talking about the lyric, which, Vic Chestnut, you wrote. The courage of the coward greater than all others. That's a quote. Tell us where it's from and what it means to you.
It's from McTeague, a Frank Norris book. And I wrote it down in my notebook where I write lines that I come across. And it was a very telling line because I was coming to see myself as a coward. And it was a very illuminating line in my own personal story.
Like, in what sense do you think of yourself as a coward?
Well, in personal relationships, I don't want to confront my enemies and things like this, you know. I mean, in many ways, I'm a coward. I break up an email instead of calling you to your face, that kind of thing, you know what I mean? And when I came across this line, it felt real and felt true.
There's another quote that you use in the lyric, "The courage born of despair and impotence." Tell us about that quote and what it means to you.
Yeah, that comes from the Radetzky March by Joseph Roth, or whatever his name is. It's another line that it felt true. You know, it was kind of the flip side of this coward, of the courage of the coward. It kind of, they dovetailed nicely together and helped illuminate this idea I had of, hello, my name is Vic Chestnut and I am a coward.
Can I ask you about the accident? Is that all right?
Sure, of course.
Would you tell us what you know of what happened?
Well, I don't remember anything of it. I don't remember the whole day, really. I was so drunk. You know, it's quite a cliche, a stupid teenager out drunk. And then I had a drunk driving car wreck, broke my neck.
Was anyone else hurt?
Nobody else was in the car. I ran into a ditch and flipped over and just, you know, broke my neck.
How much movement did you lose?
Well, I'm a quadriplegic from my neck down. I'm an incomplete spinal cord injury. That means that I have feeling all over my body, and I can move my legs a little bit. So it's a very strange injury. It's not like your typical spinal cord injury. It's very, very different.
But you play guitar, right?
I play guitar, yes. My fingers are definitely affected greatly by my injury. Greatly, in fact. My fingers don't move too good at all.
So how do you manage to play?
I just figured out a way to do it, you know. It's very strange. It's hard work to do it. It's not easy.
No, I know some quadriplegics don't have a lot of breath support, and it's hard for them to sing. But
yeah.
You don't seem to have trouble with that.
Well, I think one half of my diaphragm is completely paralyzed. The other one, you know, I think that one half of my diaphragm kind of works.
How did your music change? Where were you headed before the accident musically?
Well, I played, my chords were a lot different. There was a lot more kind of odd chords and things in my songs before I broke my neck. I also, you know, I was 18 when I broke my neck. I didn't really have anything to say at the time. I wasn't sure. I just didn't know what I wanted to say. It was only after I broke my neck, and after even like maybe a year later, that I really started realizing that I had something to say. And physically, when I could start playing the guitar again after about a year, I realized that all I could play were these kind of, you know, G, F, C, those kind of chords. And so that's what I was going to do.
Vic, how did you learn to write with chords? What did you study that introduced you to chords?
Well, my granddad taught me how to play guitar in the late 70s. This is how he taught me how to play guitar. My granddaddy, he would show me the chords to Sweet Georgia Brown in G. And then we would play that song for an hour without stopping. And well, my granddad would play lead over it. And I would play the chords. And then that would be the lesson. And then a week later, we would come and we would do, okay, Sweet Georgia Brown in A flat. And then we would do it that way. And we did it until we played all 11 keys, and that was it.
Did you enjoy that?
I loved it. It's so much fun. My granddad was such a great guitar player that it's fun to listen to him, like, improvise these leads, you know. He would go play it through pretty much straight, you know, and then he'd go off. And it was pretty much fun to watch him, and he was having fun doing it. He didn't say anything to me, like, good job or... you know, anything. We just sat there. It was a silent exercise. And it's one of my great joys in my life, is thinking back on that.
I want to play another song from your new CD, At the Cut. And this is a song called Granny. So tell us about the song.
This is a very strange song. This song is the only one I've ever done this with, but I dreamed it. I dreamt it completely as is on this album. I was in a hotel room in Toronto, and I dreamt this song. I was looking at my granny. She was at the kitchen sink, and I was looking up at my granny from the perspective of a child, and I was crying in my dream. And I woke up, and the pillow was sopping wet. My face was all wet, so obviously I was actually crying. And I realized, holy moly, this is a great song. And so I reached over, and I got the hotel stationery and pen, and I wrote down the lyrics exactly as they were in my dream. And then I reached over and got my guitar, and I figured out the chords. And, wow, there it is, straight from my subconscious to the recording tape. I mean, it's an incredible thing that's never happened to me before.
And does the song come out of real life?
I mean, it's pretty much, something I could sing to my granny. I mean, in my dream, I was singing it to my granny. The last line about, you're the light of my life and the beat of my heart, she always told me that. It's about, you know, she said that I came around just when, you know, not a year after her husband died. And, I had a special place in her heart because of that. So, I mean, it's really, you know, very much straight out of my life and straight out of my subconscious.
Okay, this is Vic Chestnut with his song Granny from his new CD, At the Cut.
Granny, oh, Granny, where did your husband, my granddaddy, go? Where did your husband, my granddaddy, go? She said, he went off to heaven just before you were born. She said, he went off to heaven just before you were born. She said, he went off to heaven just before you were born. And she said, you are the light of my life and the beat of my heart. She said, you are the light of my life and the beat of my heart. She said, you are the light of my life and the beat of my heart. She said, you are the light of my life and the beat of my heart.
That's Vic Chestnut from his new CD, At the Cut, and that song is called Granny. So were you very close with the grandmother who you wrote that song for?
Yeah, that granny, it's my dad's mom. She lived in the house with us, and so, you know, she kind of took care of us. My mom and dad were commuters. They had a long drive from Pike County to the Atlanta airport into downtown Atlanta. So they were gone before I got up in the morning, and they came home late in the evening. And so my granny was there to take care of me and my sister. And yeah, she was great.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today's show is a memorial for songwriter and singer Vic Chesnut. He died on Christmas Day, taking his life with an overdose of his prescription muscle relaxers. Chesnut had been what's described as an incomplete paraplegic since 1983 when he was in a car accident. He was 18 then. He was able to transform his struggles with depression and other demons into moving and dramatic songs. We're going to hear from three of his close friends who also worked with him. Michael Stipe of REM discovered Chesnut playing at a bar in Athens, Georgia, and produced his first two albums. Guitarist Guy Picciotto, co-founder of the band Fugazi, played on Chesnut's album North Star Deserter and on his final album At the Cut. He also toured with Chesnut. Filmmaker Jem Cohen collaborated with Chesnut over the years on many film and music projects. Michael Stipe, Guy Picciotto, Jem Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air, and I'm so sorry for your loss. I know how close you all were with Vic. I'd like to start by asking you if you wouldn't mind to share a favorite memory of Vic.
I can start. This is Michael. This is such a silly thing, but from time to time I'll write a lyric, and I'll think that I might have stolen it from someone that I know. There's a point where I wrote a song called New Test Leper, which takes place in a television studio, like a talk show. And I wrote the lyric seven times before I got it right. I finally got it right. And I ended it with this beautiful line, kind of commenting on this talk show and the people that were involved in it. What a sad parade, what a sad parade, repeated over and over again. After I wrote the song, I realized that what I had done was I had stolen a line from Vic Chesnut. And so I had to call Vic on the phone to say, tell me what song of yours has the line, what a sad parade, in it, repeated over and over. And Vic said, none of them. And I said, well, Vic, I know this is such a Vic Chesnut lyric. I'm pretty certain that I stole it from you. You know, think hard. And he's like, I never wrote that line. That's yours. Which to me was funny and sweet because I had to kind of kiss the ring of his brilliance and his brilliance as a songwriter, as a friend. And as someone who clearly had a massive influence on me in what I do.
That's a really nice story. Does anyone else want to go next?
This is Jem speaking. One memory I have of Vic that I really love, and I can't pinpoint it in time, but he often played a kind of undersized, essentially acoustic guitar that almost looked like a toy guitar, because that was part of his being paralyzed, was that he couldn't really handle a big one. And I just remember being completely bowled over by seeing him take this little tiny acoustic guitar, and he plugged in like one or two pedals, and out of the amplifier came the roar of a freight train, like the craziest, most amazing distortion I've ever heard. You know, I mean, it was like Neil Young's Crazy Horse packed into some, you know, invisible pocket on Vic's person. And I just thought that was the wildest and most hilarious thing. But it was also an indication of how savvy he was about music, because he really knew how to make minimal means do extraordinary things. And so just the image of him playing this tiny guitar and then having that the option of making that incredible wallop come out of it is something that's very dear to me.
Guy, is there one you'd like to share?
We just came off tour on December 6th, so I just finished doing a couple months of touring with Vic. And the days on tour were, you know, they, particularly with Vic, more than with any band that I've been with, they were really long. We would spend from the morning when he woke up to 4 a.m. in the morning hanging out in his room. The way he hung out with the band or the way he hung out with us was, it was really constant. So it was kind of like a thing where it was just being immersed in Vic, you know, in such an intense way. And the thing that I think people might not know about Vic, but which was so powerful for me, was the fact that his mind was always processing and always working on stuff, to the point where at the end of the night, Because in the past, sometimes he'd be like, yeah, let me have my guitar in my room or something like that. But on these last few tours, he would be like, do not let me have my guitar in my room tonight. Because it meant if he had the guitar, he would stay up till dawn and past dawn writing. He couldn't stop. And it was the kind of thing where it was like, you know, it's like Odysseus tied to the mast or something. He was like, do not let me have my guitar so I can try to get some sleep, because he was just on such a burn, you know. And in the last period of time that I was working on him, I've never seen anybody just have such a creative gushing happening where he just was so in some kind of zone like that I've never seen before. You know, just music was just pouring out of the guy, and yeah, to the point where he was like, you know, please take this out of my hand for a while.
Excuse me for bringing this up, but could that have been the kind of manic side followed by a depleted,
no,
depressed side? No. He was just that.
I don't think so. I think because Vic was like that. I mean, I wouldn't try to put a pathology on his creativity at all.
Vic also loved words so much, and I think I would listen to his songs, and I would listen for the one word that he would try to shoehorn into a song. And if you listen to each of his songs, you'll find one word that probably has never been put into a pop song before. Vic loved using words like rascally or what is the word in Spanish? Every single song has some crazy word, often
seven syllable squirrely,
some weird word that he would try to cram into a lyric and try to make it rhyme. And I love that about him as a writer. He loved his craft, and he turned it into something that was much more than craft.
Can I ask you to each choose a song that you particularly love of his and that you'd particularly recommend to our listeners?
It's hard because there are two songs that – there are three songs, and I told Jim about one of them. The song Panic Pure for me is one of my favorites. I think about the lyrics of Miss Mary and how absolutely brilliant they are and the perspective that he was writing from when he wrote that song. And I think about the song Lucinda Williams and Settle Down on a Hurt as Big as Robert Mitchum. Just that in my lifetime, that someone put that thought together and put it into a song that I can now sing in my head over and over and over again, that's a great gift. I'd love to write a song that is one-tenth that brilliant.
Let's hear that Vic Chestnut song that Michael Stipe was talking about. This is Lucinda Williams.
Imports and altercations, my faculties on a shoestring vacation. I settle down on a hurt as big as Robert Mitchum and listen to Lucinda Williams. Rubber knives. I'm a dastardly villain doing belly dives. Now before he, except after me, I'm dousing my vitals at breakneck speed. You and
That's Vic Chestnut performing his song Lucinda Williams. We'll continue our Vic Chestnut memorial with his friends Michael Stipe of REM, guitarist Guy Picciotto, and filmmaker Jem Cohen after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today's show is a memorial for songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut, who died on Christmas Day, taking his life with an overdose of his prescription muscle relaxers. My guests are three of his close friends, Michael Stipe of REM, guitarist Guy Picciotto, co-founder of Fugazi, and filmmaker Jem Cohen. When we left off, I'd asked them for their favorite Chestnut songs. Jem Cohen's choice is one that Michael Stipe just mentioned, Panic Pure.
In Panic Pure, I think in a way it's germane to this whole conversation, because in that song, you know, you see this balance of light and darkness, and also this kind of declaration of his own complexity. You know, he says, and so all you observers in your scrutiny, don't count my scars like tree rings. my jigsaw disposition, its piecemeal properties, are either smoked or honey cured by the panic pure.
It's hard. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's hard to get through it because it's so heavy, but it's also, it's just such beautiful, weird words, you know. And I think that he was always coming around to saying, yeah, there's this panic pure in me, but that's not the only force. There's also all of this other curiosity and all of this other drive and all of this other intelligence, and I just can't believe that he pushed as far as he did, you know, and kept delivering, you know.
Here's the song Jem Cohen was describing, Panic Pure, from Vic Chestnut's CD, West of Rome.
And so all you observers in your scrutiny, I don't count my scars like the trees. My jigsaw disposition, it's a piecemeal properties. Are either smoked or honey cured by the panic pure. Yes, 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 by the panic pure. And so all you observers in your scrutiny, I don't count my scars like the tree rings. My jigsaw disposition, it's a piecemeal properties. Are either smoked or honey cured by the panic pure. Yes, 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 by the panic pure.
That's Vic Chestnut singing his song Panic Pure. Chestnut took his life and died on Christmas Day. We're talking with three of his close friends, Michael Stipe of REM, guitarist Guy Picciotto, co-founder of Fugazi, and filmmaker Jem Cohen, who collaborated with Chestnut on film and video projects. Now, I don't know if any of you will have a memory of this, but since he was always writing songs about everything, is there a song that comes to your mind, any of you, that you wouldn't put on a record that, like, his friends knew but no one else would know?
But, you know, I think he certainly at soundcheck, he would just invent stuff on the spot, and it was always just absurdly profane, and no matter the context of the venue or what it was, it to me it was sometimes like he would delight in how much pain it would cause me. Like if a parent of someone in the band was at the gig, like let's say, you know, the drummer's mom was there at the sound check to come and say hi, he couldn't help himself. He would just start saying the most just completely over the top foulness, and you would just be dying, and you'd see the confused look of the parent in the crowd, and you'd just be like, just like I saw him at the Kennedy Center. Like, this was in the Memorial Hall of the Kennedy Center during the summer, a free concert series. It's just, you know, it was just every kind of humanity you would ever imagine at the Kennedy Center. Tourists, children, old people, a giant bust of JFK's head there. And he just went on this insane, profane riff about JFK being a horn dog and Jackie O being incredibly hot. And everybody was just, nobody could, everyone, I was just like burning. My face was just so hot. And then when he does the show, he just breaks everybody's heart like crystal, you know. That's his thing. He would just, he had these just incredible poles in his personality, you know, and he was a true punk. He had no fears about being provocative or pushing people past any kind of sensible limit. You know, that was his thing.
On his last album, which Guy, you worked on with him, you performed on it and did some of the arrangements. He has a song called Flirted With You All My Life, which he described as his breakup song with death. It's a song about flirting with death and then deciding, death, I'm not ready. And after hearing that song, a lot of the listeners who, like myself, people who didn't really know him but who would listen to him, thought, well, that's probably, those thoughts of suicide are probably behind him, at least for a time. And when I interviewed him in late November, which we ran in early December, the impression I walked away with is that he was in a good space, and that at least for now he was going to be in a good space. And that's part of why it was so shocking that he took his life. I mean, you know, people, his fans and certainly his friends knew that he'd tried before. But did you know that he was in a bad place now, that, you know, before he took his life, that things were bad for him?
Yeah. I did. A lot of his friends and family did.
Can I jump in on this a little bit?
Go ahead.
Vic was very open and honest about whatever state he was in. And so we knew that he was having some kind of a mental breakdown. There were, you know, bouts of terrible depression and insomnia, and, you know, in between him being his usual funny and smart Vic. But this was serious, and it was clear to people, and people scrambled to get help for him. And he was actually quite open to it. He was open to help. And so I think, you know, for people to think that maybe he rejected that or that he just simply wanted to kill himself, I don't think that's right, personally. He tried to get better, and the people around him tried to help him. You know, there was a local nonprofit healthcare center that tried, and a lot of steps were taken right away. But he was in a serious crisis, and when it came to dealing with a certain level of crisis, in my opinion, the system failed him. I mean, there were limits to what the emergency options were in his city, for one thing. Like, there used to be a psych ward at the hospital, and there isn't anymore. And then, you know, there were bureaucratic tie-ups, and things are always made harder for people in wheelchairs and so on. And, you know, in the course of that struggle, Vic took an overdose of the prescription pills, the muscle relaxants that he had to take every day, you know, that he'd taken for many, many years. You know, and that's what happened.
In the interview that he recorded for our show, he said he was worried about the possibility of losing a kidney because he didn't have adequate health care coverage, and he owed a lot of money to the hospital. He was afraid he was going to lose his house. Because he had, you know, a pre-existing condition, because, you know, he was paralyzed from the waist down, it was very hard for him to get health insurance. The health insurance he did have was very limited. It covered hospitalizations, or at least certain hospitalizations. He said it didn't cover his medication. It didn't cover doctor's visits.
My understanding of Vic's insurance was that it only covered catastrophic conditions or emergency kind of situations. And Vic would wait and wait and wait and wait until he couldn't take whatever compounded things were going on with his body. And then he would be taken to the emergency room, at which point his insurance would kick in and pay for part of the cost. I think that these compounded other issues and other problems that he had and made it very difficult. And as Jim said, we have a system in this country that completely, absolutely, and completely failed him as a person, and I think fails many people.
You know, Terry, I think one of the things that we've all talked about is that we feel that to just say, okay, poor healthcare killed Vic Chestnut, no. I mean, that would be very reductive, and I don't think that any of us would say that. But did it add to the weight that he carried? You know, did healthcare problems add a lot to his stress, to the load that was on his shoulders? To me, the answer is undoubtedly yes. You know,
absolutely.
Today's show is a memorial for singer and songwriter Vic Chestnut, who took his life and died Christmas Day. My guests are three friends who work closely with him: Michael Stipe of REM, guitarist Guy Picciotto, co-founder of Fugazi, and filmmaker Jem Cohen. A few weeks before Chestnut's death, I recorded an interview with Chestnut and Guy Picciotto, who had recently recorded and toured with Chestnut. Guy, can I ask you something? You were part of the interview I recorded with Vic in late November, and he sounded so good in that interview. I mean, he sounded really together and reflective, and he sounded like he was in a good place at that moment. Was he just rising to the occasion for the interview? Was he already really depressed?
No, I don't think so. I mean, but I mean, I think we've probably said it 100 times today. Vic was an incredibly complicated person with just a very, with all kinds of things in him at all times, you know. And I've worked with him a lot in the last few years, and I mean, his capacity for joy or for bringing joy or for, you know, certainly for being creative, his, you know, his love of conversation and community and friendship and all those things, I don't think they ever ebbed. I don't think they ebbed at the end. And it makes it very confusing for us, I think, who are still here, because it's just that light that was in him. I don't think that light ever went out. I talked to him every day, you know, on the phone, and there were some very hard conversations, and then we would be laughing our asses off, you know. And that was Vic, you know. He had a very different I think he had a very different balance between light and dark and life and death and all these things than many people do, you know. I think throughout his life, even when he was a kid, I mean, he had experiences up to the edge of death through his whole life, you know. And he had experiences through his whole life of really, and again, I'm not talking pathologically, but just really intense highs and really intense lows. And he lived in those moments very, very deeply, and he processed them very, very artistically in a way. To be a privilege to have been next to him to see some of that was, you know, it's one of the great pleasures of my life, you know. So I don't think he was putting on a good face. I think Vic was always in the moment, very genuine and very true and very sincere and very, very complicated, you know. It just is, that's, he was one of a kind like that.
I feel like if there's, when you did that other interview with him, there was a discussion about this song of his, Coward. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, Vic was saying to you directly in this interview that, you know, he feels he's a coward. And what I want to say, and I said this to Vic, is, hey, you know, I beg to differ, because I think that what we have to look at here is 27 years of this unbelievable life force operating against really difficult odds, you know? And it's not a coward that looks that hard at all these things that other people don't want to look at and then makes 16 records full of, like, poetry and humor and, you know, yeah. And also this kind of unflinching, sometimes devastating honesty, you know. And then there were film and theater projects, and, you know, right at the end, he's like, Jam, I'm writing a screenplay, you know. And so I think that that's courage, and that if there's anything that comes out of this whole situation for me, it's that that has to be the focus, is that life force. He could have gone at many, many other moments. And if everybody now is going to just sort of obsess over, like, the details of his death, or if they're going to see it as kind of another one in a line of sort of, you know, cliche musician deaths, right, I think that's really missing an enormous opportunity, because I think that we're talking about one of the great songwriters here.
I agree.
I know he was in a coma before he died, and you were, the three of you were with him, I believe, when he died, and it sounds like you are still very deep in mourning for him. I just really want to say how sorry I am for your loss, and how much I appreciate you talking about Vic Chestnut with us. So thank you very much.
And thank you, Terry.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
That was three of Vic Chestnut's close friends. Michael Stipe of REM produced Chestnut's first two albums. Guitarist Guy Picciotto, co-founder of Fugazi, played on a couple of his albums and toured with him recently. Filmmaker Jem Cohn collaborated with Chestnut on film and video projects. Vic Chestnut took his life and died on Christmas Day. Right after we recorded that interview, Guy called our producer, Amy Sallet. He said he thought of the song he'd really like us to play, Sewing Machine, which Vic would often play solo as an encore at the end of their sets on the last tour. Guy described this as maybe the most perfect of Chestnut's nostalgic songs about growing up in Pike County, Georgia. I'm Terry Gross.
Suck in your gut, clench your fist, just finish scaling a big black fish on a bench out behind the tool shack in a patch of the poison sumac. Mama ordered us some catalog jeans, and she made the cuffs on the sewing machine. Sewing machine.